Okay. Milena Woese, thank you for taking time to speak with me.
It's my pleasure. I'm always happy to help. My name's Colin Robertson. I'm more commonly known as Millennial Woes because that was the name of my YouTube channel back in the day. And I'm a writer, a speaker, video maker, sort of artist, a researcher, an organizer to some extent. And I talk about topics that are of interest to me and that have always been of interest to me, which would include culture, psychology, morality, politics, and just what it is to be alive and aware, which leads to no end of topics to discuss, really.
Do you want to mention that you were doxxed and, for a moment, known as the Vile Vlogger?
Right. And a number of years ago, I was doxxed in the newspapers. That is, my name was revealed. And up until then, for complicated reasons, I never thought that my channel, my project, would really lead to anything. So I kind of went into it quite naive. Well, I did. I went into it very naive. But I did have the sense not to reveal my real name. However, not revealing your name leaves you vulnerable to someone else revealing your real name. Because when your real name is known, that does change your life. It does have repercussions. And some people play this down, but it in my experience, it really does change your life. Nothing is ever quite the same again, apart from anything else, because the media have had a field day with you. And they've demonized you and made you look dreadful. And I often think if somebody were to know me only by my Wikipedia page, they would think I was a complete, a dreadful person. But I honestly don't think I am. And I do think that I've reached all of my opinions, my beliefs from a spirit. Well, I think I've reached them carefully. And I think I've reached them with a spirit of honest inquiry, and a concern for sanity, stability, my own kind, and the truth. So it was never political in the first sense, you know, that it was not ideological how I embarked on this. It was just I wanted to understand, and I think, you know, I'm not complacent about this, but I think I have reached quite an advanced level of understanding, because what other people say, what my opponents say, I can very quickly neutralize, whereas they can't neutralize what I see, at least in my experience. And I don't want to seem arrogant about this, but I've never, certainly in the last sort of 5 years, I've never heard one of my opponents saying something and thought, oh shit, I don't know the answer for that one. Very much the opposite. I always feel like they're stuck 20, 30, 50, 200 years in the past.
I've asked to speak with you because I'm trying to find some answers to certain questions. Some of these questions are a bit taboo, I suppose. Some of these questions less so, but there's a world of material out there. There's a lot of questions on my mind. And I just think that you are someone who could provide some interesting answers. In particular, I was wondering if you would like to tell us your thoughts on diversity. Now, I've always been told the slogan that diversity is our strength, that it's a good thing. But I'm starting to have some doubts. What's wrong with diversity? Why is it not our strength?
Well, diversity is division and complexity and chaos. Diversity means that nobody really knows who owns the place that they're living in, who sets the tone there, to whom it belongs, really. And it also introduces a lot of of course, diversity, variety in daily life, but it's actually more than most people can handle in any meaningful sense. So, for example, people who celebrate diversity tend to say that, well, first of all, they'll say that it's about the food. You get an incredible range of restaurants. But that's very shallow and silly, and they know that deep down. So they'll dignify it by saying, and I get to learn about all these different cultures. But then you ask them, well, okay, which cultures have you learned about? And how much do you know about them? And the answer is generally, once you whittle down the defensive answers, it is revealed that really they don't know anything about any culture. Because the truth is, most people aren't actually interested in other cultures but their own. It's too much to take on. There are individuals who are, but most people, it's too much work. It's the unknown. It's meaningless to them. At most, what they'll glean about other cultures is some superficial tidbits, some factoids, but it's all meaningless. There's nothing that you can really do with it, except repeat it to someone else at a later date, this isolated factoid. Well, big deal. That's one thing about multiculturalism, diversity. Another thing is that it does lead to competition between groups. Diversity is division. It means that the place really doesn't actually belong to any one group in particular. In theory, it belongs to all groups equally. In reality, that is only a temporary situation. As we see and have seen in countless places around the West over the last 50 years, what always ends up happening eventually is one group will gain precedence in each area, and the other groups will either by force or by choice vacate that area, and then it becomes dominated by that one group, either dominated completely, entirely, or for 90%. Now, there are places that this doesn't happen in. They tend to be like the very city centers, the places where there's a lot of money, a lot of commerce going on. But then what you have is just globalism. There's a lot of money. It's not a dump. It's not a nightmare. But it's not a cultural, it's not culture as we used to know it. It's entertainment. And I guess, so yeah, it's diverse. There are lots of different people, lots of different foods, lots of different fashions on show. But again, all of this is very superficial. So, but ultimately, the thing that's wrong with diversity is that it makes a place unknown and unknowable for everyone in it until it becomes undiverse again, because some group has finally laid claim to it.
Would you say that diversity kills genuine diversity?
Yes. Yes. You see, another thing that I should say about diversity is a lot of the time it actually requires a huge amount of authoritarianism, what you might call a police state. Now, that hasn't happened yet, at least in many places, but I can easily foresee, I can see signs of it being on the way throughout the West, because diversity causes conflict. It causes competition. It causes resentment. It causes mutual suspicion. And no one knows what the situation really is. So it's always up for grabs. And so everyone is therefore trying to gain precedence in that space. And so this is why you need an overarching authority to keep everyone, to keep it under control. So you end up with a police state or something akin to that. That's another problem with it. Now, as for does it kill real diversity? Yes, it does. Either the groups come together and then separate again, in which case you've got diversity. They're still separate, but you've only got diversity because they are separate. And that's, a thing of human nature, that people stick to their own. Birds of a feather flock together, and that goes for human beings as well. But then where they mix, well, then you don't have diversity anymore. And as I say, the only type of diversity that can last when people mix is a very superficial diversity, where you've got the Chinese guy and the Italian guy, and they both enjoy French food cooked by Indians. Well, it's all very shallow. It's all very meaningless.
Now, you mentioned mutual suspicion and competition and conflict, but hold on a minute. Isn't that our fault or our government's fault for not integrating these people well enough?
Well, the governments have tried to integrate them in different ways in different countries, and it simply hasn't worked. I mean, we've been doing this for decades now. It's in the case of Britain, it's since 1948, and it hasn't worked yet. I mean, there are fortunes ploughed into integrating immigrants every year, and it just doesn't seem to work. It works where in cases such as high IQ Indians who want to integrate, they want to do well in that society, although they also want to make it a new India, I found in my experience. But in the case of many immigrants, they can't integrate, and they don't want to either. So no matter how much the host culture tries to help them integrate, they're either incapable of, or they simply don't want to do it, because that is for them to give up what they are and what their parents were and their grandparents were and their great-grandparents were. It's actually asking a hell of a lot of someone to integrate into a different culture. So I don't think it's our fault for that they haven't integrated. I think it's human nature.
So you mentioned globalism. Now, this is a word that we've heard from people like Trump. We've heard it from far-right populists in Europe, lots of them railing against globalism. But it seems to me that globalism is just a reality of the world we're living in, of the age we're living in. I can get on the internet and buy something from another country and get it delivered to me within days. I can use a VPN and be using the servers of a different country and have access to that country's websites, or get beyond the paywall or the firewalls of other countries. I can travel for lower prices and at faster speeds than ever before in human history. What's so bad about globalism? And if it's bad, if you have criticisms of it, what are you going to do about it?
I would draw a distinction between globalization, which is a process or a set of processes, and globalism, which is effectively an ideology and a way of looking at life. And it's quite political. Globalization is a sort of prosaic reality that probably was inevitable, probably was to some extent unavoidable. And I don't think it's necessarily undesirable. It can have bad effects, but I think it also does have many good effects, and it would be ridiculous to deny them. As you say, there are numerous convenient things that come with globalization, and I don't need to list them. They're obvious, and we all make use of them every day. Whatever our preferences, we just do. But that's very different from globalism. So globalization, yes, I'm broadly in support of it, as long as it happens under the auspices of a nationalistic government or a nationalistic way of looking, a patriotic way of looking at life. Globalism interferes with that, because globalism says that, well, the nation state is dead. It's irrelevant. At most, it's an amusement. What we should all do is mix everything together. And populations don't necessarily belong anywhere. They should move to wherever they're economically needed, wherever they can make more money, wherever it suits them. And also populations aren't important in and of themselves either. They should just disperse, diffuse all over the world. So it destroys homelands, it destroys populations, peoples. That's just one of the effects of it. There's a lot else to it. Globalism means that everything becomes meaningless. Everything is possible, and therefore nothing actually matters anymore. And this is why rural places, for example, villages, lose their vitality because they're no longer nurtured. Things become centralized in big cities because that's just easier in terms of organization. It's simpler, it's more streamlined, it's more efficient to centralize things, including people. So the ramshackle existence that we used to have, where things were scattered and random and very organic, that becomes lost in the maelstrom of seeking efficiency, of the drive for efficiency. And again, that is part of globalism. It's extremely technocratic. It's extremely materialistic. It sees man and woman only as economic units, animals, in a sense. So that's another thing. And I think I see that in Britain. I see it every country I go to. Another thing is that every place ends up being the same. So every country I go to, there's a Burger King, a McDonald's, a Five Guys, Domino's, KFC. And then in other sectors, the same thing. It's the same companies everywhere. So there's almost no point traveling anymore. So you've got homogeneity. And then another effect is the brain drain, because people in poor countries end up moving to the West or to wealthy countries so that they can make more money, like the intelligent people do. And so that deprives the places they came from of the most intelligent people, who are the people they need most. And those are the places that need those people most. So they should stay at home in their own countries and improve those countries. But in a globalistic system, there's no incentive to do that and no sort of ideological reason to do that either. They could make more money in Berlin than in Kabul, for example. So they'll just move to Berlin. That's one. Another thing. And then another thing is, as I said earlier, about unrealistic expectations. I think globalism means that the sky is the limit, at least in theory. I mean, this isn't actually the reality of it, because there are actually only so many jobs available. But nonetheless, it gives people the illusion that they can be anything and achieve anything. And so then they don't become anything. They get lost in that. The unrealistic. It's the equivalent of the dating market, where you think, well, I've got a million choices, so I shouldn't take one of the 10 obvious choices. I think in a similar way, the same thing happens with culture, with jobs, with travel, all sorts of things. Globalism implants very, very high expectations in people about pretty much every aspect of life, which leads to serious disappointment later in life. That's just a long-term effect that I can foresee and that I'm beginning to see in the world around me. At any rate, the effect of that is that people and places suffer because they're no longer getting the nurturing that they need and that they would have got by default in a pre-globalism world.
Can you go back to that statement you made about the places you've seen in Britain and other parts of the world that are beginning to all look the same, feel the same, everyone's doing the same things? Can you go on for a bit of your personal experiences with that? How it made you feel? Describe what you saw and felt?
Yeah, I've been around Britain. I've gone to many different towns, visited many different places and villages. The villages still retain some individuality. The towns, a lot of them have been renovated recently and in recent decades, and they all look the same. There's a certain type of British town that was renovated, refurbished, whatever you would say, revamped in, say, the 90s or the 2000s. And they all look, the town centre looks the same, the layout looks the same, the type of road surfacing they use is the same everywhere. And so every town centre becomes indistinguishable from every other town centre. So then there is nothing to distinguish that town from any other town. So there's no reason to go to any other town, but there's also no reason to value your own town because it's not special. All of the specialness about it has been stripped out and replaced with something generic and homogenous. And not homogenous in a good way either. It's not an organic homogeneity. It's an enforced universal homogeneity. And what I'm saying just now is true of that. You could say there's a British style, but increasingly you can also say that there's just a Western European style or even a Western style. So every new building looks the same. You see new skyscrapers and they could be in any country in the West, almost any country in the world. It could be Dubai, it could be Stockholm, it could be Paris, it could be Chicago, it could be London, it could be Oslo. It just doesn't matter anymore. And this is because of not just globalization as a process, but globalism as an ideology and a way of life.
Very good. Okay. You said that diversity can cause the creation of an authoritarian state. You said you foresee it and you can even see it happening now. What are some examples of this? I think we live in an age of more freedom than ever. We've never had more free humans. We have free speech, freedom of expression. Women can vote. We have just immeasurable freedoms. What is this authoritarian state you're talking about?
Well, I'm banned from PayPal. I'm banned from YouTube. I'm banned from Patreon. I'm probably banned from several countries. there is an authoritarian state. My Wikipedia page is just nothing but a hatchet job. There is an authoritarian state. It's just not, well.
But isn't that because of the consequences of your what you've said? I mean,
because
we have cancel cultures, that we have consequence culture, and you've said things, and these are the consequences. No,
I think if that were the case, then it wouldn't happen so universally, and there would be ways to tackle it in each case, whereas there isn't. You're up against a behemoth. And every part of it supports every other part of it. It is a state. It's just not tied to any particular geographic zone, as in the states of old, where you'd have the British state, the German state, the French state. We now are up against something that's very amorphous. And so, yeah, it is authoritarian. And it can operate through the national governments as well. I think there is authoritarianism. And the reason for it is that different peoples thrust together will find any number of reasons to dislike each other, to resent each other, to be unsure of each other, and even to hate each other, which is very unfortunate. It's not pleasant, but it's a human reality because humans are animals. You know, we are not above those instincts. But also the instincts themselves are essential for survival. If you don't care about your group, and if every member of your group doesn't care about your group, then the group will simply no longer exist. So it's a survival instinct. But it leads to animosity towards other groups. It just does. Oh, well, whichever group you want. You could talk about the Taiwanese. You could talk about the Congolese. Or you could talk about the French, or the Scots, or the Germans, the Bavarians. You could go as narrow as you like.
These are just arbitrary meanings. Like, at the end of the day, we're just individuals. What makes a person French? What makes a person Taiwanese? And, you know, and are these groups' identities, they're always in flux anyway, are they not?
Well, you know, it's sometimes said that pornography is very difficult to define, but you know it when you see it. In a similar way, you could say, I can't describe a Frenchman, but I know one when I see one. I know one when I meet one. The attitudes, even the phenotype, how he looks, how he dresses, his attitude to life, his ancestral history, his genetics, the language he speaks, of course, the culture that he knows, and the politics that he knows. All of these things, some of them are genetic, some of them are cultural, some of it's nature, some of it's nurture, but all of these things go towards creating something that is undeniable. It is a real thing. It belongs to a real category, along with other people, other Frenchmen, for example. Is it arbitrary? Are the edges of it blurred? Yes, but that doesn't mean it's not describing a real thing. You could say that all concepts are social constructs. They're all invented by us, but they're invented by us so as to approximate realities in the world. And you can say that the edges are blurred, that one thing evolves into another, like blue evolves into purple, into red. But you wouldn't say that therefore purple doesn't exist because blue and red exist. Or that blue and red don't exist because purple exists. That would be a stupid thing to say. And likewise, with animal breeds, different species, there are all different breeds of dog or breeds of cat, but no one denies, yes, they're all cats, but no one denies that they're also of a particular type. They're a particular type of that animal. So why not with human beings? Why is it suddenly with human beings just a figment of the imagination, just something that's inconsequential and not even real? You might say it's inconsequential. You'd be wrong about that as well. But to say that it's not even real, it is ridiculous.
If you're a group, for example, you are Scottish and broader British, but in Scotland, aren't the majority of your group, your fellow Scots, opposed to you? What do you do about that?
Yes, they are. They are. That's because I'm the guy. I'm the kid saying that the emperor has no clothes on. But just because there's only one kid saying that doesn't mean that the emperor is actually fully clothed. A lot of people can be fooled all at once, especially if there are social incentives for them to remain fooled, for them to keep believing something that they know to be a lie, or that if they investigated, they would find out is a lie. So they choose not to investigate it. It's just too dangerous. It's too dodgy. Nobody wants to be a pariah. And as something of a pariah myself, I can say that it's not nice. It's not pleasant to be a pariah. It's not something that I glory in. So that means that a lot of people have a huge incentive to just go along with the consensus, no matter how ridiculous it is. So yeah, the Scots, on the whole, most of them would disagree with me, would say that they despise me, hate me, they think I'm an idiot. But then most of those people, if they found themselves walking down a dark street at night and there were four young black men approaching them, most of them would shit a brick.
Very good. Let's talk about the Great Replacement. Do you believe in the Great Replacement?
Yes, the Great Replacement is just an observable fact. It's not a theory. The only room for doubt is in whether it's deliberate or not, whether it's happening deliberately, whether it's an orchestrated plan, or whether it's just happening by accident, organically, an emergent phenomenon. But you can't deny that it's real because it's just clearly real. It's just obvious, it's visible. It's ever more visible by the year. So, I mean, you can look at pictures of London in 2003, 2013, 2023, and each of those pictures is going to look very different. And certainly if you go back to 1973, 1923, it's ever more white the further back you go, to the point where in 1913, it's virtually, if not literally, entirely white. But the same photo today of some street in London will be extremely mixed. And if we go by the average statistic, it will be less than half white. So, and that's replicated across many different cities in many different countries around the West. So it is simply happening. There is no denying it by any honest person. Simply cannot deny this obvious, observable fact. So then you've got the only remaining question is it deliberate? Is it happening deliberately? And the answer to that is, if any government wanted to stop it, they could. They don't, therefore, they either want it to happen or they're being forced to allow it to happen. But then you've got the fact that they're openly celebrating that it's happening. So clearly they aren't against it, really, in any real way. They're quite obviously up for it. Therefore, they want it to happen. Therefore, it's happening deliberately. And you could say that the national governments don't really want it. They're just acting on pressure from elsewhere. Well, then that means that by definition, it is happening deliberately. Because pressure from elsewhere, that means what the UN, the World Bank, BlackRock, whatever. But it means that the most powerful people in the world want this to happen. So by definition. So yes, it is deliberate.
Okay, so there is this mass migration happening in your country and in other countries in Europe, and we could include the United States and Canada in this as well. But what does it matter? We can get these new migrants, the new populations, to adopt Western values just as we have always done. And immigrants are always looked on with suspicion. They're always frowned upon at first, and then later they become accepted. We've seen this play out in the United States. It's the history of the United States. The Irish, the Italians, they were treated with suspicion. They were discriminated against at the start, and now no one could imagine America without its Italian and Irish immigrant population.
So, well, they'll have to, because soon enough those Irish and Italian populations won't exist because they'll have merged.
But what does it matter? This is just
well, you just said that everyone values the Italian population, clearly, according to your own argument, it does matter.
But
you're fucked.
Very good. Very good.
I can give a different answer.
No, that's fine. That's good. I think that's fine. Okay. Okay. You said that you feel like a pariah, and you know that many of your fellow countrymen aren't on your side. Is it because you sound racist? Are you a racist?
I think it's a non-question. It's like asking, are you evil? And there are some people who, I guess, would enjoy the idea of being evil, and so they would answer, yes, I'm evil. But I don't enjoy the idea of the connotations of the word racist, because it basically, it equates to evil. It means you're stupid, you hate everyone, you're uneducated. First of all, I wouldn't like admitting to those traits. But secondly, I don't think I have those traits. So to say, I'm that, would be silly. It would also be just bad PR. It would be suicidal PR to say that. I think that other people have flirted with that word in the past, and it, actually, including me, I have flirted, like, jokingly, ironically, with that word in the past. But it was a stupid thing to do, because you're painting a target. You're doing your enemy's work for you. But to answer the question, am I racist? No, I care about my own kind. I care about my people. And that doesn't mean that I hate other people. I really don't. I hate some individuals, but as types, no, there's no point. So I don't hate them. But if by racist you mean, do I care about my own kind? Then the answer is, well, yes, I do care about my own kind, just like everyone else does today, and just like my ancestors have always done throughout all of human history.
But you want to stop people from coming to your country based on their skin color or their religious beliefs? How does that flies in the face of human rights? It flies in the face of all of the moral evolution that we as human beings have undergone over the centuries. Does it not?
Well, if I wanted to move to China tomorrow, I don't think it would be a straightforward process. If I wanted indeed to move to any other white country, I don't think it would be a straightforward process. I think that every obstacle would be put in my way that could be put in my way. So I don't really believe that the world is as you claim it is. But secondly, do I think that everyone should just be able to move to the West? No, for numerous reasons. Logistical, we just can't handle that number. But and cultural, we can't integrate them, and that's been proven, that's been shown. We haven't integrated the massive numbers of people who are here. And then thirdly, for racial reasons, I do value the existence of the European people, the European race, the white race, because Chinese people value the existence of the Chinese race. It's just a natural thing. So no, I don't think this is a bad point of view. I think it's a natural point of view. I don't think it's a destructive or hateful point of view. And I also think it's a sort of, I think it's a healthy and inevitable point of view. It's the natural point of view. Children even will prefer, babies will prefer the company of their own kind. Children will prefer the company of other children who look roughly like them. There can be a few exceptions, of course, but generally speaking, people stick with their own kind. And I don't think that is inherently a bad or evil tendency. And I do think that it's a tendency that you can only combat with great force and persistence. And even then, you're never actually defeating the tendency. You're just stopping people from enacting it.
In Britain, you have large groups of people, Sikh Indians, Pakistanis, Afghans, people from the Afro-Caribbean population that were born in Britain. If you ask them to produce their passport, they will produce a British passport. They speak English. Britain is all they've ever known. In many cases, they've never been to the country of their parents or grandparents. What do you propose to do with these people? Aren't they just as British as you?
No, they're not, for a start. That's the easy answer to that question, is they're simply not. But they are something, and it's something that has never existed before. You can say that the Indian guy who was born and brought up in Britain, he's an Indian. And in some cases, he will be so culturally Indian that it's true. But in other cases, he will be so westernized that it's not really fair to call him an Indian. In which case, he's, as I say, something that has never existed before. He's a nowhere man, a hybrid. which isn't the end of the world, but it does mean it does put a spanner in the works, and it gives him an identity crisis. In some cases, he might be okay with that. In others, he might be very troubled by it. This is often the case with people of who are split in terms of their mixed race or their displaced geographically. So there are large numbers of people who would say that Britain is their home. It's all they've ever known. Here would be my solution to that. If they're over 40, if they're over the age of 40, I would just let them stay, because they're probably not going to reproduce, especially the women after that age. So they're not actually an obstacle to restoring Britain as it was. So I would just let those ones stay. But the younger ones, I would make deals with their governments. I would seek to make deals with their governments, no pun intended. And I would encourage them to move back, especially if they are under 40, then they're young enough to, they've got the energy to discover something new, so to speak. But it would also be something very old, something that perhaps has been calling them all their lives, and they ignored the call, buried it, but were always bothered by it. Well, maybe we can help them solve that problem now.
One of the images people have in mind, or something that comes to mind when they hear nationalism or ethno-nationalism, is basically bloodshed and tyranny and genocide and killing and persecuting millions of people. How do you respond to people that would say what you want requires the murder and persecution of millions of people, innocent people?
I don't agree with that. I don't think that it's inevitably violent or murderous. I do think it would be difficult, and I'm not delusional about it, but I think that people are they're quite malleable in this sense. They're quite open to persuasion. If you made it attractive for them to move to another country, their ancestral country, I think a lot of them would just do it. And indeed, if the West ever collapses into some sort of civil unrest situation, I think a lot of these people will just decamp to their ancestral countries. They'll suddenly find that actually they're not that British after all. I'm quite, call me a cynic, but I do get that impression from a lot of people. But no, I don't think that mass violence or mass killing is necessary or desirable. I want to make that clear. I certainly don't advocate or enjoy that prospect. I think that they came over here peacefully. They can leave here peacefully. It just needs to be negotiated. It just needs to be worked out. Exceptions aside, of course, there will be exceptions, but I don't think this needs to be a dreadful, bloody conflict.
Okay, let's do two more things and then we'll wrap up. First one, can you expound on the moral grounds for ethnic nationalism, or for nationalism, just as you see it? What is the moral framework? What are the moral grounds for what you believe?
Well, it's very simple. We exist and we want to survive. And that's it. And I don't think there is any need to say anything more than that, because no more than that would be demanded of any other group who were fighting for their existence. Okay. So I could answer that last one again if you want. I mean, I don't want to seem too glib. I would say it's very simple. We exist and we want to survive. We want our group to continue existing. And the only part of that that is open to discussion, as it were, because nobody else would be asked to justify their existence. So the only part that's open to discussion is that we exist. So the question is, well, who are we? What do I mean by we, and how can I prove that we exist? And the British people, you could break that down into the Scots, the English, you could break those down into different groups as well. But broadly speaking, it's been the same for 1,000 years or more. And so to say that we don't exist is just ridiculous. I mean, of course we exist. Of course we always existed in the lives of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents. Everyone knew who the British were, not only by their fashions and their manners, but even by their appearance, their phenotypes. So it is just the truth that we exist. And this was something that was never denied until very recently, the last couple of decades. There is such a thing as a British person. There is such a thing as a Scot. There is such a thing as a Celt. Even now. And this shows, you see these types of people. And as for the second part, that, well, we want to continue existing, that does not need to be defended. Nobody else, no non-white group would ever be asked, well, why should your group continue existing? It would just be taken for granted, and it should be taken for granted. I mean, this is not some puzzle. Of course I want my type, my kind, to exist. It's crazy to ask me to feel any other way.
It strikes me that we do speak about the importance of things existing when it comes to, you know, the polar bear or the panda bear or some exotic type of bird. And I couldn't help but thinking, as you mentioned, even the Celt. You know, red hair came to mind as I was listening to you, and how we know that the population of people with red hair is dwindling, and that particular gene that produces red hair is increasingly rare in this world. And I think it would be a shame to live in a world with no polar bears and no gingers. So I understand what you're saying there.
Well, red hair, green eyes, and fair skin. That is a type of person that has existed for thousands and thousands of years. And if diversity and globalism continue apace, that type of person will no longer exist and will never exist again. And if we were talking about some exotic animal species, some subtype of a species, it would never need to be defended. But of course we want this to continue existing. So why on earth does it need to be defended here? The answer, I guess, would be, well, in order to keep it existing, we'd have to undo a lot of the processes that we've been engaged in over the last 100 years. Yes. Yes. And that's okay.
Well, are you just afraid of change? Are you just someone who doesn't like to see change?
Well, I'm not a huge fan of change. However, I don't mind positive developments, good developments, change for the better. However, I have seen footage of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and I cannot imagine how change in that direction from the starting point of a first world European country would be for the better. So in that sense, yes, I'm afraid of change.
Well, Millennial Woes, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. It was enjoyable.